Welcome to Becoming Church, the podcast where we discuss how the message and movement of Jesus is not just about becoming Christians, but about becoming the church. I'm your host, Kristen Mockler-Young, and my guest today is award-winning author, collaborator, and storyteller, Mark Tabb. As soon as I saw the title of his latest book, which comes out this Tuesday, I knew I wanted to talk to him. It's called, Am I a Better Christian on Zoloft? And Other Questions About Faith I Should Probably Keep to Myself. I will tell you, I read this recently, and it immediately jumped to the top of my bookshelf as a favorite. Here's my conversation with Mark Tabb, so you can know just exactly why.
My name is Mark Tabb. I am the author of a brand new book called Am I a Better Christian on Zoloft? And Other Questions About Faith I Should Probably Keep to Myself. When people hear the title, they either go, what? Or they laugh. Usually they kind of go, what? And then they think about it. And yes, it's supposed to be a little ridiculous, but you know, the answer to that question is, I really am.
Yeah.
I'm better at airports. I know that.
So. Yes. Well, I think that I follow Revell, who is your publisher on Instagram. Yes. And so I think that they must have done a post or something. And I saw the cover of your book and I laughed out loud. And then I immediately went to my contact there and I was like, hey, I need an interview with this guy because this sounds amazing.
Well, thank you.
Yes. And I have read it. My husband and I just came back from the beach last week and I just kept laughing out loud. And so I was making notes and underlining things and cracking up. And he would be like, what's so funny? I'm like, it's this book. It's so good.
I'm glad to hear that. It's, you know, humor like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because I've been married for almost 43 years, but there are some things where my wife's like, that's not really that funny. And I'm like, I think it's hilarious. Yeah. No one else is going to think this is funny. So I'm glad somebody did find this humor. Because that was my goal. I wanted it to be a little irreverent. I wanted it to be kind of snarky because the stuff we're talking about are things we need to be irreverent.
Irreverent.
Because it is irrelevant, some of it, and a little snarky because some of it's ridiculous. You know, it's just kind of things in the Christian culture that I'm like, come on.
Yeah.
We're not doing that anymore.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, you're on the right podcast because we're not super churchy and we don't super spiritualize things over here. We love Jesus. We love loving Jesus as people. And then everything else, you know,
is kind of God love people. Those are two commands, you know?
Yes.
That's it.
I want to dig into this book because I want to intrigue everyone else that's listening to read it also. But from the very beginning, Mark, you said, I miss the days I had all the answers. And I think that's the very first thing that I underlined in here. So what are some things that you have changed your mind on that maybe you used to be certain of, but aren't any longer?
Would it be wrong to say just about everything?
No.
You know, I think I came up in when my wife and I started having kids, and we got married, you know, like in grade school. She was 18, I was 20. So we've been married a long time. But we had our first child right around the rise of the whole Christian parenting advice movement. Yeah, okay. Before that, long before, like my parents, they had nothing. Dr. Spock was around, but you know, my sisters and I say we were raised by wolves because my parents were just lucky we were good kids because it was a free for all. So my wife and I, we had our first child, and that's when James Dobson's Focus on the Family film series was out. So we watched this and we're like, because we have this child, we have no idea what to do with her. And, you know, she can't tell us because she's just an infant. And, you know, so there was implicit in that, you know, some good advice, strong-willed child. I mean, I have five daughters. And so my firstborn daughter was in charge of our household from the moment she came into our lives. I mean, she was 14 when she told me, I said something about it's my job to raise her. And she goes, Dad, I'm already raised.
So, I'm growing at 14, Dad.
I'm in charge. She was always in charge. But implicit in that Christian movement of first advice on parenting, then there was advice on relationships, and then there was, you know, the love languages, then you came the purpose-driven church, the purpose-driven life. You have all these things, and so implicit in them, and I'm not throwing them all out, you know, but there was almost kind of like a guarantee. You do this, this is how things are going to turn out.
Yeah.
No, they don't.
Right.
No, they don't. You know, like one of the chapters is called, "Did it really make any difference? I didn't let my kids watch The Simpsons when they were growing up." And daughter number two, she just laughs. She says, "No, Dad, all it did for me was produce an atheist who doesn't get cultural references."
Oh.
And it's a funny statement, but also it's kind of like, yeah, one of my daughters is an atheist. Mm-hmm. Grew up in a pastor's home, grew up hearing the Bible. I mean, we didn't force things. So, you know, I have my oldest daughter who has written books on her own. She was a full-time worship pastor. Now she does that part-time, works at Mission State University. Daughter number three has started in her living room when she was fresh out of college, a nonprofit that works with women in the sex industry. It's called Unconditional, and it's a, you know, faith motivated, is how she describes it. So full-time ministry for two of the three of our bio children. And, you know, one in the middle is an atheist. There's no guarantee. I mean, they all came up in the same house.
Yeah.
You know, so that's really where this is coming from. It's just the idea that certainty is an illusion.
Yes.
And the sooner it took me a long time to figure that out, even though my favorite Bible verse is Ecclesiastes 7:14. It says, "When times are good, be happy. When times are bad, remember, God sends one as well as the other. That way you'll know that nothing in this life is certain." Mm-hmm. So that's when I say, you know, I had all the answers. I don't have any answers now because nothing is certain. I don't know how things are going to turn out. I don't know. You know?
Yeah. And I think, Mark, I think there's a lot of, I was born in 82. I know a lot of our listeners were raised in the 80s, in the 90s. Yep. So not as, some of them were parents the same, you know, having children the same time as you, but a lot of us were probably raised at the same time frame as your daughters. So we are all nodding along going, yep, yep, yep. Like we remember all of this.
You were our little experiments.
We were. And listen, even those of us that quote unquote turned out, we still have our own issues, you know? Exactly. So
and that's the thing too. I think so much of that, it was all kind of, you know, designed that everything's going to turn out great, you know, with your kids, with relationships. This is how you will not have your marriage end up in divorce. And yeah, I went through that with my parents. It was one of the turning, you know, one of the formative experiences in my life. I was determined that my children would never have to live through that. But, you know, one of my kids, she's gone through a divorce, and life happens.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can do. You can't pray it away.
Right.
You can't build these Bible verses around it. You can't build a hedge of protection around it or put an umbrella over it.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's just life. It's a fallen world.
Yeah.
It's like C.S. Lewis once said, when people were upset over somebody, you know, some of the tragedies in life. And I can't remember the exact quote. I just remember he said, you know, but didn't they realize everybody was going to die?
Yeah. Yep. Well, and isn't it better to give your daughter than a God who cares about her circumstances and her situations and wants to be right there with her and is right there with her in it, instead of saying, well, if only you had loved him better or were a better representation of him, this wouldn't have happened. Like, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. And it puts all the emphasis on us. But also, one of the things that really, really prompted me writing this book was just kind of the formula of faith. You know, it throws out the Bible Band-Aids. And I talk about that in the first chapter, because that was one of my experiences as I went through just trying to get a handle on my own depression.
Okay,
and,
yeah.
You know, prayed more, and people throw out these little pithy sayings. And I'm like, yeah, I don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
But I also, in my writing career, and I'd had a long break in between my individual titles, where I did collaborative books. But I've written a lot about suffering, and one of my earliest books, I think I wrote it in 2002 and then did an updated version in 2009, I think. It's called How Can a Good God Let Bad Things Happen? That was also a reaction against formula faith, but it was very serious. And this is not as serious. People don't like serious, but I also find, you know, there's a serious point, but you know,
well, humor is a pathway. It opens doors to conversation and to getting to people.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, we love learning. We love unlearning and relearning over here, but I know that there are people who haven't really gotten comfortable with changing their mind yet.
Yes.
Practically, if people are in that place, how would you encourage them to maybe face the fear and start asking questions?
I think one of the best is hang out with people who aren't like them.
Oh, good. I like that.
And not to argue, but just hang out with them or go to places that they've not been before. I mean, so I was a Southern Baptist pastor.
Don't worry, we'll bleep it out.
Okay. But, you know, I grew up in Oklahoma where everybody was a Southern Baptist.
Yeah.
In the 60s and 70s, the people who weren't Southern Baptists were Pentecostal, and all the Pentecostal churches were full of former Southern Baptists.
Okay.
I'm not making this up. Catholics were so rare when I was growing up in Oklahoma. That when I was in sixth grade, we did a field trip in our vacation Bible school class to go to a Catholic church in downtown Oklahoma City just to look at it.
Oh my gosh.
Because it was like, what, a Catholic? Where? I mean, there was none. There was one Catholic church around. So that's how, you know, I was pretty sheltered, but so one of the things that was kind of ingrained in me, and I don't know why, I think it was one of the churches, well, it was a church where my wife and I got married. It was basically a pole barn and, you know, it's a metal building that is so cheap. And so kind of one of the convictions I had was, you know, spending a lot of money on a really fancy building is that's a waste. And, but a couple of years ago, my wife and I, and things, you know, started changing, but when we were in Barcelona, and we went to the cathedral there, whose name, because I'm from Oklahoma and I live in Indiana, and we butcher the English language, the something familiar, you know, the famous.
Sure, sure. We can all Google it.
Let's all Google it because I can't pronounce it. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And it's been under construction for 100 years. And it just took my breath away. And I thought, all of this for the glory of God.
Mm. Yeah.
So. Yeah.
It's
like, man, I was stupid. Who wants to, you know, doesn't make it more holy having church in a pole barn than in this grand cathedral? I mean, what is going to put your focus upon God? So those are kinds of things. So get in places. What I had to do was to go to places where people thought different, where things were different, and it kind of rocked my world. You know,
where you don't, quote unquote, know everything already.
Exactly. Exactly. And we moved around. I grew up in Oklahoma. We lived in Texas for a while. Lived in California for a while. That changed me. Loved California. Then we ended up in Indiana, and I was a fish out of water here.
It's a little different.
It's a little different. But, you know, and all those different, being around people that are different really prompts you to start asking questions. And also, I mean, there's a line from Ted Lasso that I quote in the book, always be curious, not judgmental.
Yeah.
You know, because you want to learn, you know, and even you don't travel, you don't hang out with people who are unlike you, read books that are different than what you've read before.
Yeah.
I had my whole theological education, all that was, that's why I went to Texas school there. I had never read anything by John Perkins up until maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And when I did, it just blew my mind because I was like, why wasn't this book came out in the 70s, Let Justice Roll Down. I was like, why wasn't this part of my theological education? Should have been. So just start branching. And also, you know, I think we always are to be lifelong learners. And the key to that is always just asking, you know, really? Well, why is that?
Yeah.
And does that work? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, just layering the questions. I found that to be one of the best things too, is you ask one question and then you go, okay, but why? Okay, but where did this come from? And we just keep asking and we just keep digging and until eventually we'll find some kind of answer, even if it's not a specific certainty,
right.
We'll find something.
Well, that's why the last chapter is called, What If I'm Wrong?
Yeah. Which is a question that I hate asking, but
not a question I asked probably the first 30 years of my life. I was pretty sure I'm right. And then, having kids, that's just.
Yeah.
That makes you start questioning stuff as well.
I want to know what it was like as a father. So you've got these five daughters.
Yes.
And so you raised your five daughters thinking, very specific things. What was it like when you began rethinking things that you'd previously raised them to believe? I'm assuming y'all didn't all go on this journey at the same time and pace.
No. Well, one of the things that I did, so our two youngest daughters, we adopted when they were teenagers.
Okay.
And if you really want to have your world blown up, do that. That's been almost 13 years ago. Almost 14. So one of the things that I had always encouraged my daughters to do is to think for themselves.
Good.
To ask questions. My daughter, who is now an atheist, she went to a Christian college here in Indiana. And it wasn't until she was in her residency as a doctor that she, turned loose of everything. But when I would get in the car to drive her back to school, she would open up a notebook. She goes, okay, Dad, I've been reading the Bible. Here's my questions. And we would just talk about stuff. So that was one of the things with my girls is I always encourage them to not just take the pat answers, I wanted them to think for themselves, to think things through, to always be curious. So when they read this book, they're like, of course, this is my dad. Okay. So now the things that do surprise them is I think on social media one time I was in the middle of a book. And so I play music when I'm writing. And so I said something about when Come As You Are by Nirvana comes on, you got to crank it as loud as it'll go. And my oldest was like, what? Because she grew up listening to Newsboys, audio,
right. Yes.
Christian rock, which
same, right.
Doesn't exist anymore.
Yes.
Yeah, everything's positive and encouraging now.
Yes.
So
okay,
that surprised them a little bit. Okay. But they also, they grew up hearing me sing to Jackson Brown at the top of my lungs in a car.
Sure. Listen, you got to have some surprises for them still.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I want to jump into the book. I'm going to quote you to yourself a couple of times here.
Okay.
From some of my favorite chapters. And so in the first chapter with the same title, you say, I might be a nicer guy while taking Zoloft, but that doesn't mean I am becoming more like Jesus as a result. Behavior modification is a side effect of the Christian life, not the point of it. So Mark, in your language, in your love language of sarcasm here, are you saying that checking the boxes of my self-righteousness is not how to know if I'm a good Christian?
Yeah. That's what I mean. But in the Christian culture and subculture, even as we talk about legalism is wrong, you got all the boxes to check. And when somebody doesn't check, and it's not like, you do LSD. I didn't think, not things like, but just little things like, I lost a friend one time over Christian rock.
What?
Because it wasn't hymns I was listening to. He was like, that's devil music. Like, what are you talking about? It was Russ Taff. Right. Guitars behind him. This was before you were born. Or not, right after you were born. So there's things like that with, I had a conversation about this book in a church where I was on staff part-time for a long time and went there for 20 some odd years and we're not there anymore. Because I knew I figured I would get fired from the church when they read this book in the chapter called Did the Church in Ephesus Have a Creative Arts Director? I knew that would be the end of my time on staff at that church.
Like, they're not going to like this one.
They are not going to like this one. But I was talking to a friend of mine in the foyer and he was asking about the book and I told him the title. He was kind of like, what? You know, I wasn't sure what to think of that. And then I started going through the chapter titles. And, you know, when I said, well, one of them's called, "Can I Call Myself a Christian If I Don't Watch The Chosen?" You what? You don't watch The Chosen?
Yep.
No. What do you watch? Well, I really like the show on Prime, Bosch, because I love Michael Connelly's books. You what? And it was like, wait a minute. How are you a Christian and you're watching that kind of secular junk?
Yeah.
They're good stories.
Right.
So right. those are the boxes that really start getting checked. And then all the others, you know, it's just that we think if somebody's a nice guy, a nice woman, well, you know, that shows the fruit of the Spirit. No, it doesn't. I mean, the two commands are love God, love people.
Yeah.
And I can be patient and kind and just a sweet old man and not love God and not love people. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of Christians right now who are saying the right things, but not actually living it out, or who are checking all of the legalism boxes. You know, they've memorized their Bible verses and they've got the scriptures in their Instagram bios, and they're having their quiet times, and but they're not looking more and more like Jesus, Mark. I'm gonna tell you that.
Yeah, and that's because the hardest thing, and that's the hardest part of my journey on getting help with depression.
Yeah,
was to finally humble myself and say, I cannot fix this. Yeah. And I know it's one of the, you know, the 10 steps. Is it 10? Yeah.
Yes.
Step program. Yeah. But that was the hardest thing for me to do. And I didn't have a problem with, you know, I had worked through the theology before about, you know, well, the Bible says be anxious about nothing. How can you take something to cure anxiety or depression? Prayer should be enough. And it's not. It is not. It's not going to cure a chemical in my brain. It's not right. So I worked through that. But then just that idea that I could not fix this. When I found myself broken to that point of humility, that's the essence of the Christian life. The verse I quote to myself daily, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. So whatever humbles me is good.
Yeah.
So, and that's where, when I say, am I a better Christian on Zola? That is the answer of yes, is because this process was humbling. Very humbling. And so this morning when I took my Zoloft, I thought about that again. And there's times where something would be going on, you know, we'll encounter something, my wife and I, and I'll say, well, it may just be the Zoloft talking, but because it does keep me calmer.
She's like, whatever it is, I will take it. I will take it.
When we were at LaGuardia Airport 2 weeks ago, and our flight was delayed, and then canceled, and we were at the airport for 12 hours and ended up renting a car the next day and driving from New York back home to Indiana because my youngest daughter lives in New York. I was really, really calm. My wife was very, very happy that I was on Zoloft. Yeah. So my anxiety just didn't take over.
Yeah. Yes. Well, listen, we are very supportive of both Jesus and science here. We love Jesus and therapy and whatever you need for, you know, chemical ailments that you cannot just pray away.
Exactly. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yes.
I'm in the right place.
You are. We're big both and over here. Yeah. If you're enjoying this conversation on looking at the nuances of faith, be sure to go back and check out some of the other episodes here on Becoming Church. We talk a lot about unlearning, relearning, how to evolve in your faith, and what to do if the people around you tell you that it's wrong. And just a little insider information from me, since you're here. If you really find yourself intrigued by the idea of leaving a faith that's built on certainty, make sure you're following along with me at Kristen Mockler Young on social media, because I will have a book for you next year. Did you pick up on that hint? Okay. Now here's the rest of my conversation with Mark. Well, you did mention chapter 2, which is if you can still call yourself a Christian without watching The Chosen.
Yes.
And I will tell you, while I generally think Christian media is super cringy and I bypass most of them, I am a big, big fan of this show. I love this version of Jesus. Elizabeth Tabish, who plays Mary Magdalene, has actually been on this podcast.
Wow.
Yes. She's a fantastic person. But so obviously I was super intrigued. That was one of the first chapters that I read because I was like, hold on, Mark, we can disagree, but what are you going to say here about The Chosen? And I was actually happy to find out that it's not really about The Chosen at all. So talk to us a little bit about what chapter two is and what the concept is there.
Well, chapter two, I'll go back from when my first book was published in 1996.
Okay.
I was a pastor of a church of like 50 people. I should not have gotten a publishing contract. I sent in a book proposal, unsolicited, and Moody Publishers, they published it. They told me it was the first time in 5 years they'd pulled anything out of the slush pile and published it.
Wow.
So we're leading up to the release of my book, and there was a Christian Bookseller Association. They used to have a winter meeting called CBA. Okay. And it was at Opryland in Nashville. So okay. My wife and I would go down there, and I meet with the three main people at Moody Publishers, and it's an incredible meeting. And the editor who bought the book, Jim Bell, great guy. I remember he and I, we walked out onto the floor of the CBA Expo, and it was like the Christian subculture all under one roof. And it's Opryland, so it's a very large roof. And he looked around, and that was the first time I'd even really thought about this. He goes, man, we got a whole little subculture here, don't we?
Yeah.
And it had, you know, I brought home, I got free a game for one of my daughter's Game Boy. It was Moses, you know, leading the Israelites through the wilderness.
Seriously?
For his Game Boy. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'm laughing because I'm shocked that my parents didn't find that one. I didn't know that existed.
All this kind of stuff. You know, it's also where I discovered Jars of Clay for the first time. First album had just come out. And I wrote my second book to that album. So chapter two about, can I call myself a Christian if I don't watch The Chosen, is really about the whole subculture. And just saying, well, this is safe, so I can do this. And people's reaction to this is strong, which is why I wrote that chapter as I'm doing a Q&A with a large anger group of people, which includes a guy with torches and pitchforks, like he's coming after Frankenstein. Because people are like, I don't like this. But the problem is, and so that's where Romans 12, 1 and 2, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind comes into play.
Yes.
Because it literally says, because I went to school to study Greek, it literally says, do not conform to this age. Mm-hmm. And so what are the, and not being conformed then is the renewing of your mind means learning how to think, not what to think, but how to think, how to look at things in an objective way, how to look at it in a biblical way. And so just the whole point of this is if we approach the Christian life and our consumption of media, like that book, Eat This, Not That.
Yep.
There's no renewing of the mind.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of bad theology that's out there that parades around. I did a book early on with a guy who was a Christian artist back in the 90s named Clay Cross. He was very big back in the day. And I remember him telling me that at the height of his career, his walk was horrible. He was addicted to pornography. His marriage was hanging on by a thread. And he said that there were times where he was just fighting to hit the note. And there'd be this intensity on his face. And people were like, oh, look how he's worshiping.
Oh, gosh. He's like, that wasn't it at all, guys.
Yeah, it was all just, yeah. And I think that's where I really wanted to come to with chapter two is if I just swallow all this and I don't think about it, then what good is that? And while writing that chapter, I watched a movie. My wife and I started watching a movie on Netflix that people had talked about. I can't remember. It was some baseball movie or something. And we turned it off when somebody actually said, well, you know, when God closes the door, he opens a window. My wife goes, I can't believe they just went there. I'm like, I've had enough.
Done.
Only burglars come through windows, you know?
Right.
If God closes the door, Okay.
Right. Except, sometimes he closes doors.
He closes doors. So that's what that chapter is about, is think. Because there, and like I said, there's some bad theology in a lot of the songs that are popular. There's ridiculous. I mean, it's like one of the things I don't like about the struggle with Christian movies. A lot of times the acting is not great.
Not great. Yeah. Not great.
But also everything works out in the end.
Uh-huh. And that's not real life.
That is not real life.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if everything works out, then the sun comes up the next day and it's not going to stay just right. I mean, it's like a fairy tale. Then they lived happily ever after. Yeah. I like the reels that have the Disney princesses in therapy.
Yeah.
That's how real life is.
Yeah. Well, and it brings a lot of hidden shame to people who grab onto that kind of theology, because they're like, well, then I must not be praying hard enough. I must not be a good enough Christian, because if God truly was with me, then the sun would come up for me tomorrow and everything would be great and shiny. And it's not.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Jeremiah, he was a failure. Isaiah, he was, tradition says he was stuffed in a log and sawn in two. I mean, things don't work out.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes they do. Often they do. We live in a place where we're very comfortable, but, you know, I've spent time with pastors, spent a lot of time doing training, you know, like 3 years of training, once a week with pastors in Goma, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Oh, wow.
That'll challenge your faith.
Oh, I'm sure. And give us a little perspective.
Exactly. And I know I was talking to a pastor in Mali, which is a Muslim country, and they had just gone through a coup. I'll never forget this because this touches on the politics chapter. And I asked him, I said, you know, Pastor Yosef, how are you guys doing with the coup and all this? You know, and it was, the whole country had been turned upside down. And he goes, it's politics. I was like, I wish, because his hope wasn't there in anything the government did. His hope was in Christ. He didn't expect righteous government here on this earth.
Yeah.
You know, not in a fallen world.
Yeah. And it's all expectation. I mean, you even wrote that in this chapter. You said, really what all of this comes down to is what others expect of someone who claims to be a follower of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we expect them to watch the chosen. Now, listen, I still think maybe one day you will change your mind. But no pressure. I know you said that you tried it, and that's all I ask.
The guy that plays Jesus, and maybe I'm wrong, and you might have to edit this out. He comes across as, one of our pastors the church used to go to, they showed this long clip, and watching it, it has the Jesus character on there. I'm like, man, this is a smarmy guy. Come on, man.
I love that Jesus, but I've also watched more than just that clip. You know, yeah. I've watched every episode. So, listen, to each his own.
Exactly.
God's going to use that show, and God's also going to use The Simpsons, and God is also going to use, you know, Jars of Clay or whoever it is.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite band is the Goo Goo Dolls. There's some lines from the Goo Goo Dolls I quote about life all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's truth.
Yeah.
So, you know,
like you said, you quoted Ted Lasso. I mean, God is in everything if we look for him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and so many times, you know, with people, we're just trying to get by. Mm-hmm. We're trying to figure life out. We're trying to get by. And, you know, everybody just needs a lot of grace from us.
And if we haven't learned to give grace to ourselves yet, then we don't know how to extend it to other people.
Right.
Which is where I think all of this comes out of the legalism. We have to wrestle through it with ourselves first, mm-hmm. decide already that in humility, we're going to let go of needing to know everything and certainty. And that's when our world just honestly explodes. And we realize that it's so much bigger than we thought it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Everything makes God way, way, way too small.
Yes, we put him in a box. For sure. Mm-hmm. Well, you brought up politics. And so I want to talk to you about my other favorite chapter, which is chapter 6.
Okay.
Which is called, if I really believe God is in control, why am I so upset about the last election?
Yes.
And you said in the chapter that the real question isn't about who wins, but about whether or not we believe that God is really in control. And Mark, I hate that because it can sound like a spiritual platitude. And also sometimes I just want to stay angry about it.
Right.
If I'm being honest, you know?
Oh, me too. I grew up when I was 6 years old. My dad took me to see Richard Nixon campaigning for president in 1968. Mm-hmm. It's funny because I did a book with Alec Baldwin and we've remained friends. And I told him that story. And he said, my dad took me to see Robert Kennedy the same year.
Oh, funny.
Yeah. So I grew up in just this, my dad and I, all of his life until he passed away, we'd always talk about politics. We'd always talk about baseball. And I was also, he would call me because I was his human concordance. He could never find verse in the Bible. He called me. It's like, yeah, you got a theology education. Let's use it for something.
There wasn't Google yet. No. Okay.
But turning loose that idea of, being just so intense about politics was hard but the realization is, I think in the American context, part of the reason why we put so much emphasis on politics is because of this idea that, well, America was created a Christian nation, and that's our responsibility, is to make it that way. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to, maybe it was, I don't think it was ever founded that way. It's hard to have the three-fifths rule in the Constitution and say it was Christian. But right. if it was, okay, I'll give you that. Let's say it was.
Sure.
It doesn't make it biblical.
Right.
And so what is, as followers of Jesus Christ, who are strangers and aliens on this earth, this world is not our home, and not to be just completely detached from it, because, our responsibility, love God, love people.
Yeah.
Not in word alone, but in action. Mm-hmm. So we're to be involved in people's lives. But this idea that somehow an election is going to determine the fate of God's work on earth. No, it's not. It's not. In China, the church is growing. Is the government there conducive to that? No. Was it in the first century? No. That was never the plan. Christian nation building was never part of the plan. It's biblically, it is not. And, it's just so in with that, when we put our hope in the political process as believers, we're staking our claims. That's like, me allowing my mood to be determined by whether or not the Yankees won last night. I'm happy because they did win last night. there is that. But it's something that is like the pastor in Mali told me. It's temporary. Kingdoms come and go. Nations rise and fall. Empires come and go. The constant is the kingdom of God working through the lives of people who love him and love others and put that love into action. You don't have to, because, one of the things, too, that just frustrates the fool out of me with Christians putting their hope in the political process is we don't remember what happened 100 years ago with Prohibition, which was driven by, Christian women's temperance societies and things like that. We wanted to induct, this Christian way of thinking about alcohol onto the nation as a whole. And all it did was open the door for organized crime because, people didn't realize how much they wanted a beer until they couldn't have a beer.
Right. Till they said, you can't have that. Right.
Yeah. Which is, we know instinctively too, reading the New Testament, Galatians makes it very clear that no one will be justified by the law, that the law exists to show us how sinful we are. It's not just talking about the Ten Commandments. It's not about any law, any rule. I challenge anyone that is a, it's like, Mark, listening to this, like, you're full of beans. Come on. That is our responsibility. That is our, to put laws that are going to reflect the Bible and the kingdom of God, that's our responsibility. And then people will follow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Your last trip, you took an interstate. What speed did you go?
Yeah, right. I didn't follow. I'll tell you that much.
I didn't follow that. Right. So if we can't follow that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even set my, most of us set our cruise control above the speed.
Correct. Yes.
We could keep right at 70 or 55 or whatever. So, you know, it doesn't, it just doesn't work. It didn't work. I'm old enough now. I mean, it's an old crotchety guy. I'm not crotchety, just always. But I remember when the when Jimmy Carter took office, maybe it was during Ford's time, it seemed like Carter, where they lowered the speed limit to 55 so that everybody would save gas.
Okay.
You know, and they expected to drive 55. And what came out of that was everybody got CB radios and radar detectors.
Mm-hmm. And started letting each other know where the cops were, where the speed traps were. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, my best friends and I, we drove to Kansas City from Oklahoma City to go to a Yankees and Royals game, and we ended up blowing up the engine on one guy's dad's Toyota because we were going 85 the whole time.
Oh, gosh.
With CDs, listen to truck drivers tell us where the car police were.
Yeah. I think what you, in that chapter, you really put words to, I mean, like I said, part of me, the part that absolutely lacks humility, wants to just stay angry. And I just want to be mad about what I'm mad about. Because it gives me a place to put my righteous anger, and it gives me people that I can like be like, it's your fault, you know?
Yes.
But I think what you really helped me realize was that it was the idea that we have our hope in humanity as a whole. Like, we think that everyone is going to vote for what's best for the good of the whole. And then when that doesn't, and that fails us, I think that's what a lot of people are honestly mourning, mm-hmm. that idea, right?
Yes, absolutely. As I think, you know, in the last several election cycles, we just see where people are just voting for their own self-interest.
Right.
And we're like, that is a failure of humanity. But also, yeah. I mean, isn't that the biblical picture of humanity? Yeah, we can, like after 9/11, we all pulled, I think maybe that's part of what the problem is. After 9/11, we all pulled together so much.
We've seen it happen. Yeah.
But then we fragmented.
Yeah.
So quickly.
Yeah.
But that, again, it's basic human nature. And it's kind of like, you know, we get upset about it, but it's like, I don't know if you ever saw the movie called Grizzly Man.
No.
So it was about this guy. It was a documentary. This guy who'd watched too many Disney movies. And so he decided he was going to go live with the bears in Alaska.
Okay.
It was a documentary. So there's an old saying, a bear is going to bear. And in the end, the bears ate him.
No, stop it.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Because he was filming it all. The bear, you know, you can. They don't show him getting eaten by the bears, but there's the sound of the bear growling, and then
the movie's over.
Movie's over.
Wow.
So when a bear acts like a bear, but I even saw a story because I was thinking about your questions in advance, and I saw a story from, I think it was in the Philippines or Thailand, where a guy climbed over a fence at a zoo to take his picture next to a crocodile.
Oh, come on, guy.
It took him 30 minutes to get him out of there because the crocodile had clamped down on his arm and was trying to kill him. Because the crocodile is going to do what a crocodile does.
Right.
And if, you know, if we're surprised by that, it's just because we don't understand crocodiles or we don't understand bears. And that's, I think, the hard part is we want to, you know, people generally, we're, our default setting is to be selfish.
Yeah.
We want what we want.
Yeah.
So,
do you think there's hope that for humanity that that'll ever kind of swing back and shift again?
I mean,
or is this kind of the nature of the beast?
In time saying? Of war, we, you know, we pull together because we have a common
enemy,
big picture enemy.
Yeah.
And it's something that's like, we have to, because if we don't, then all of us are in peril. So it's in all of our self-interest to pull together.
I see.
But yeah. I think it's just, you know, it's how people are. It's like, you know, what's the first word for people who have never had children? one of the first things your kids are going to say to you is no. And the second thing they're going to say is mine.
Right. Yeah.
And expecting a toddler to share without some cajoling and all that kind of stuff, it's, you know, some of them naturally do, but a lot of times it's, you see that desire for our own self-interest come out. And it's, it's disappointing. It's most disappointing when I see it in myself.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I can admit to that as well.
Yep.
Or my kids, because I'm like, did you learn that from me? Where did this come from? Yeah.
And I think, too, one of the things that that feels good about politics, especially when there's a group that we can blame things on, it makes us feel better about ourselves. But also, like watching some news channel, getting all upset, worked up over something, it almost feels like we're doing something about it. But we're not doing anything about it. We're just getting ourselves mad.
We're just reacting. Know? Yeah. Yeah.
And at the end of the day, we haven't accomplished anything.
Right. Except patting ourselves on the back and saying, good job, us. Yeah. We're on the right side.
Yeah. You got to figure it out.
Right. Well, before I ask you the last question, that is the same question I ask everyone, I do want to know if you had a favorite chapter or concept that you particularly enjoyed unpacking.
Oh, my favorite chapter, without a doubt, is a chapter, Can I Claim Jeremiah 29:11 as my life verse if I've never read the book of Jeremiah?
Okay.
I don't know where the idea came from. And the editor, at first, she said, you know, we're going to have to change this. And it's like, no, I just put a preface to it, you know, a little intro. But it is a marketing agent meeting with first Jeremiah and then with the Apostle Paul to help them make their work easier to put on a t-shirt.
I love it. I think that's one of the things I really love about this book is every chapter is different. There's essays, there's, I mean, like you said, talking to the angry mob, you know, fictionally about the Chosen, like, it's just so creative, Mark. I really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I've written a lot of books with people and I've written, you know, quite a few of my own, but I think this was a book where I finally was like, I'm just going to be myself.
I'm so glad you did.
So much fun to write. And I just think, I hope people talk about it, read it. I hope it gets a lot. Cause I think there's so many people who are in that same boat of, especially those who, whatever their age, they've been in church, they've gone through this, but they've kind of like, they're tired of it. You know, they realize formulas don't work. I don't want some Bible Band-Aid. Come on, get away from me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got many, many friends who have stopped going to church. And, you know, I was a pastor for 16 years full time. And then was, you know, went to the last church we were members of for 22 years. And when we left there, I mean, it was hard for us to. It would have been easier not to go and find another church.
Oh, yeah.
And we haven't joined. You know, I haven't joined. I haven't volunteered for anything. We went a few months without even talking to anybody because we wanted to be completely incognito.
Yeah.
But what we were really looking for in a church was something that was not slick, but it was authentic. And we found that. And, you know, I just thank God for that. But, you know, that concert feel when you walk in. I didn't want that.
Yeah.
I just wanted real life, real people. Nothing manufactured.
Yeah. Yeah. Reflections of a real, honest God.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, that's not really my target audience. There are a lot of people who are out who are like that. They're tired of the easy stuff. It's just, they're ready to laugh at some of this as well.
Right. Right.
And they don't watch The Chosen.
hey, some of them do. Come on. Because the podcast is called Becoming Church, Mark, okay. My last question for you is, how can people listening become the church to the people around them?
I think by becoming dispensers of grace. Mm. And by that, I mean, not being quickly offended by lifestyles that, I mean, people without a relationship with Jesus are going to live like that.
Yeah.
Why do we expect something different? And show lots and lots of great. And this is, you know, so easy for me to say in a reason, oh, yeah. But this has been a big part of my journey. And, you know, it's one of the things with the chapter about my children is very, very personal in ways that don't come out in the book because, you know, it hasn't been an easy road. Like I said, I have a daughter who's an atheist and there's other things that she's chosen with her lifestyle. And it wasn't easy to get to this place, but it was like God had always been hammering that down. I mean, people respond to grace. People respond to kindness, forgiveness of just, if we can learn to see people as just as people who are struggling to figure things out. That's why in the first chapter, you know, so there's not good Christians, bad Christians. There's just people trying to figure out how are you going to stay connected to God today?
Yeah.
It's just not easy. And I think if we can express that to one another, that's what being a church is about.
Yeah.
It's not about vision plans, you know, and big building plans, any of that kind of stuff. It's just about a group of people doing their best to live out as Christians, to live out what it means to love God more than anything else and to love people more than myself.
Yeah. Well, thank you for writing it, Mark. I know that there are people listening who probably listen to this conversation with you, you know, talking about your daughters and just kind of hearing you as a father, probably wishing that their own fathers showed them a little more grace or that their own fathers gave them the option to change their mind, that their own fathers had enough humility to change their minds as well about some things, and or at least, you know, have conversations. So thank you for just modeling that for your leadership. I know that's not even why you wrote the book, but it's I think a really good benefit side effect. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. This has been fun.
It's been great. I hope this conversation brought you freedom. Freedom to know that things can be holy and humorous at the same time, that you can love God and be frustrated with his people sometimes, and that you can believe in hope while also having moments of doubt if it's ever going to work out. I believe what Mark said is true. There are people you know who are looking for churches, communities, and other Christians who live in this both and kind of faith. We hold multitudes over here at Becoming Church, and we've always got room for people who are willing to engage with dialogue and curiosity. I hope you'll share one of these episodes with someone you know as an invitation to join us over here at Becoming Church, where we take loving Jesus and his people seriously, but maybe not much else. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, keep becoming the church to the people around you.